You're listening to a podcast from the Brookings Institution.
I'm Bruce Katz. I'm a vice president of Brookings. I'm a co-director at the Metropolitan Policy Program here. I just want to thank everyone for coming on an afternoon event. I particularly want to thank Governor Hickenlooper and Governor Haslam for coming here, really at the beginning of the National Governor Association meeting. I think this is going to be a really important conversation today. Because we are going to focus on the role of advanced industries in spurring American competitiveness. These are really the critical R&D intensive sectors that concentrate the nation's science, technology, engineering, math workers, their STEM workers. And we believe at Brookings and at Brookings Metro, they're absolutely critical to our future prosperity and competitiveness. I want to thank particularly the Rockefeller Foundation and a joint project we have with them on state and metropolitan innovation because they supported the work we did in Colorado and Tennessee. So I'm going to provide some remarks on the importance of advanced industries in a moment. First, I want to introduce a partner in crime, Daniel Pactod, the director of the Advanced Industries in Aerospace and Defense Practice at McKinsey. McKinsey has worked very closely with us over the past couple of years and has really provided just unique industry insights and phenomenal analytics on the role and function of advanced industries. For everyone in the room, for everyone watching, hashtag ADV Industries as you listen to Daniel and then ultimately the rest of the forum. Daniel Pactod.
So thank you, Bruce. It's really on behalf of McKinsey and Company, it's an honor to be here with Governor Haslam and Governor Hickenlooper. We've been, as a firm, passionate about advanced industries for the last several years. 3 years ago, we decided to make a significant investment as a firm to build our capabilities. And we had a chance to actually partner with Brookings kind of on a pro bono basis, providing a little bit of our private sector expertise on both accelerating the competitiveness of space in Colorado and then accelerating the competitiveness of automotive and assembly in Tennessee. We actually are passionate about advanced industry because we think it's a very important sector in the economy. Some key facts that we keep staring at, 12% of GDP, 45% of U.S. exports, a third of the productivity growth. That's what that sector represents. It's also interesting to notice that that sector has generated a lot of innovations that have spilled over in other sectors of the economy. Naming just GPS, for example, LASIK surgery, advanced materials, which actually comes a lot from defense, has spilled over in other sectors. We often talk about manufacturing. We actually think that manufacturing is only 10% of the total jobs. It's actually a lot of engineering job, engineering intensive, knowledge intensive. So we actually think that when you look at the engineering capabilities of that sector in the U.S., the opportunity for innovation and accelerating competitiveness is massive. And so that's another area that I think we had a lot of passion and energy. And then most importantly, I think I would just say, closing, when we looked at space in Colorado, for example, where, to some extent the U.S. has put the space industry on the map in the 60s, we actually got very excited when we looked at opportunities to create more funding, to bring in more investments. And frankly, same thing in Tennessee, when we actually had a chance to look at the automotive industry in Tennessee and how to actually create, attract more investments. And so perhaps we'll leave the introduction at that. I think it's been a great partnership with Brookings. We have been, trying to provide more of a private sector view on this. And again, it's an honor for us to be here and have had a chance to facilitate this debate with you. Thank you very much.
Okay, so we're just going to do a little sound of light show here. So we can all get on the same page, so to speak. So for the past several years, Brookings Metro has really been boringly consistent about the challenges before us in the United States. At one level, we just need to grow more jobs, 7.8 million jobs, to make up the jobs we lost during the downturn and to keep pace with population growth and labor market dynamics. We also, as everyone in this room understands, need to grow better jobs. because we have seen a spike in the number of people living in poverty and near poverty from 81 million in 2000 to 107 million in 2011. So we believe that the economy, and this is really the work we've been doing with McKinsey, is undergoing a slow, gradual shift, a restructuring from an economy pre-recession that really was characterized by excessive debt consumption to one that, again, can get back to fundamentals, driven by innovation, exports, human capital, and advanced industry. We think these forces, or we see very disruptive forces happening both at home and abroad, declining energy costs, shifting wage dynamics, and the changing nature and location of manufacturing. These forces really do make for an advanced industries moment, so to speak. Advanced industries, as you see on the definition, are the high-value R&D-intensive industries that concentrate our STEM workers, but more importantly, as Daniel was saying, are really at the vanguard of commercialization of innovation. So this is a kind of a super sector, right, that includes 23 industries from on the manufacturing side, pharmaceuticals, medical equipment, aerospace, and motor vehicles, just a few, as well as high-value services, software, computer systems, design, telecom. They're really often tightly linked with production. So in the past, we've always talked about manufacturing and services, the physical and digital, as if these were separate things. The reason why we're so productive, the reason why these industries matter, is because they're coming together. Good news. Industries tend to pay well, average wages well above the national average, and these are industries that are accessible to people with a wide range of skills. About half of the advanced industry jobs require less than a four-year degree. The other thing, and really Daniel was getting to this point, these are industries that punch way above their weight. Only about 5% of the jobs, 11 to 12% of the GDP. You see the numbers on engineers and architects, exports, patents, private sector, R&D. I mean, this is a platform for national competitiveness and national growth that is significant. Interestingly enough, in the post-recession period, even though they're only 5% of the jobs, their share of job growth since 2010 is about 10%. But they're only 11% of private sector GDP, they're about 21% of GDP growth since 2010. And that's why we're beginning to talk about this possible restructuring. They matter, obviously, because they're on the leading edge of innovation. They literally are developing technology that are transforming lives, particularly in the life science sector. But they're driving productivity in other sectors. They're supporting long supply chains, and they're stimulating local economies. They're driving job growth. So the radiating effect, the multiplier effect of these advanced industries is really quite remarkable. Now let's come to the states, because, you know, we all understand that at this particular moment in our country's evolution, so much of the policy innovation that's going to happen in this country is really going to be led by cities, metropolitan areas, and their states. We've had the pleasure of working with Governor Hickenlooper in Colorado. Ken Lund, who's the head of economic development for that great state, is here, and business and regional development leaders to focus on the importance of leveraging, supercharging the aerospace sector. We've also had the privilege of working with Governor Haslam, Bill Hagerty, the Commissioner of Economic Development, a great team there, and business leaders to talk about how to move advanced automotive to the next level. Just a few framing points before we turn it over to the conversation. Tennessee's auto industry, is much bigger than people think. 94,000 workers. It's not just about Nissan, GM, and Volkswagen, the big automakers. 80% of the workers are employed in small and medium-sized firms spread all across that state in the supply chain. They're the ones providing the parts, the know-how, the technologies. And as a whole, this sector contributes close to $5 billion to state GDP. When we get to Colorado, we are also looking at a very powerful sector, about 66,000 jobs. They pay over $90,000 on average. It's about a $9 billion business for the state, and obviously we all know that it's really very much of a private sector industry that looks like it's got great growth opportunities. Now, these states are not just taking their position for granted. As you'll hear in the conversation, there's a lot of smart policy innovation that is going on at that level to drive the continuous industry development, to really get workers prepared for these advanced industries, not just in the 4 years again, but in high schools, in community colleges, and then to commit to innovation at all level of the supply chain. So in Washington, which, you know, rarely seems to have a good news story, this is a good news story of very powerful industries in critical states of our country where public leaders, private, university, civic are working together to leverage their distinctive strengths. Now we get to the main event. This is just a warm-up, right? You know, otherwise, there's just no sort of build-up. So we are really privileged to have Yuki Noguchi here. For those of you who are NPR addicts, I count myself as one, you will hear her on Morning Edition, All Things Considered, the Weekend Edition. You know, what she excels at is really very clear, very smart reporting on business and economic development stories at the national and subnational level. Again, I want to thank both governors for coming. I'll invite Yuki to the stage. And let's have a great conversation. Thank you very much.
Thank you to Brookings, and thank you all for being here. Thanks to our honored guests. The gentlemen before you today have a lot more in common than their party affiliations might suggest. Both are former businessmen who've done quite well. They're apparently friends. Would you like to dispute that?
Guilty.
Both are former mayors who took office in 2003 and worked there until they became both governors in 2011. Both have worked in the oil industry, as it turns out, and both appear to be fans of baseball, if I'm not mistaken.
That's true.
Which is something I have in common with them. Both have some background in the industries they're about to talk about, arguably anyway. Governor Hickenlooper started his career as a geologist, is that right? And Governor Haslam started pumping gas at 13, which
true.
I think counts as being part of the auto industry.
Long supply chain, right.
Governor Haslam was born and raised in Knoxville, Tennessee. He grew up in a prominent business family and helped the family business, Pilot Corporation, grow. Upon election, Governor Haslam has set job creation and long-term economic growth as his top priority, along with education and workforce development. So please welcome Governor Haslam. And Governor Hickenlooper can talk about STEM education because he has one. His geologist career was stopped short in the oil industry in Colorado when the industry collapsed in the 1980s. But some would say
connection there was there.
Well, he recovered. He co-founded the Wine Coop Brewing Company, which got him involved in the redevelopment of Denver. In his latest State of the State address, Governor Hickenlooper also talked about jobs and the economic health of Colorado. So please welcome Governor Hickenlooper. We will be taking audience questions later in the program, but I thought I'd start off with a few questions myself. And hopefully we can keep this a lively conversation, because one thing I know from radio is that droning is boring and boring is bad. So we will try to avoid that collectively.
I think we just got lectured.
So just to open, Governor Haslam, you're talking mostly about how to expand the auto industry in Tennessee, and Governor Hickenlooper, you're focusing on aerospace today. And we have gotten some background on why advanced industries are important economic drivers. But maybe each of you could discuss why you're focusing on these industries in particular, how they fit into your economic vision, and maybe a little bit about your state's history with those industries. So Governor Haslam, would you like to start?
Yeah, our state's history with auto business goes back to the late 70s, early 80s, when then-Governor Lamar Alexander, now Senator Alexander, went to Japan to try to talk Nissan into building a plant in Tennessee. The response was predictable, where's Tennessee? And so Governor Alexander was prepared for that, and he came up with one of the great props of all time. He took a nighttime photo of the U.S. Showing population density by the lights that showed up on the map, and said, see the center of all the population there, that's Tennessee. And that got their attention, and Nissan ended up building a plant in Tennessee, which became the first of three manufacturers. Later, GM built what was originally their Saturn plant in Middle Tennessee, and then several years ago, Volkswagen built down in Chattanooga. For us, you know, as you come in as a new governor, actually, I don't know if you remember this, when we were both elected governor at the same time, we'd been friends as mayors, and several of us were standing outside in the hallway during one of the, they send you to new governor school when you're elected, and we're standing outside talking, and somebody, we kind of, after a while, I said, well, how close was your primary? Did you have a tough general election? And then, so what'd you run on? We all kind of, after a little while, sheepishly admitted that we were going to be the jobs governor. And so we realized that all 30-plus new governors at that point in time were going to be the jobs governor. The point of that is it's obviously a very competitive world out there. In a competitive world, you try to figure out what are your strengths. And so you can go try to be all things to all people, or you can say, you know, we're not bad at this. And so I came in and saw that we had developed a solid auto business with a great supply chain. Like I said, about 70% plus of our jobs in the auto industry are not from the three manufacturers, but from all the parts or all the related suppliers. And so we decided to renew our focus there. Again, I think you compete where you have an asset and an advantage that you can use, and where there's a lot of continuing benefits. And mayors and governors love to, you know, trumpet job creation announcements, but the truth is all 500 job announcements or 1,000 job announcements are not the same. Some of those come with, as you all call it, a long supply chain that is of great benefit, and we've seen that played out in Tennessee. Mm-hmm.
Governor Hickenlooper?
Well, first, I do want to point out we also share, in addition to having been mayors for the exact same 8 years and got elected governors on the same day, we also share Peyton Manning, and regardless of the outcome of the Super Bowl, right. He is one of the great human beings on earth, and I think we share that deep respect. So we did go to
we'll take the Broncos.
No way.
It's orange, it all works.
So the new governor's school, one thing you see, and no different than Congress, governors come from all different backgrounds, but there's only a handful. There are actually, I think last time I checked, there are five, maybe six, who are actually entrepreneurs who build a business from scratch and really create something significant. And so Governor Haslam is one of those others. So we are not only, we're mayors for the same period and did work on the same kinds of things, education, infrastructure, as mayors, but then when we became governors, did both kind of elbow our way towards the front of the line in terms of how we're going to create jobs. And Bill's exactly right. It is a function of taking what your assets are and saying, how are you going to leverage those and magnify them? What's the transition points where you can really take the existing assets and grow them? And we did a thing we called the bottom-up economic development plan. We went out to all 64 counties in Colorado and asked the local county economic development folks, what do you see in the future and what do you want to have happen? And we found, you know, there were six basic things we saw all over the state, right? They wanted the state to be more pro-business, you know, get rid of red tape. They wanted the state to have a better access to capital, better training of the workforce. They want us to market the state, brand it not just as a tourist destination, but as a place for entrepreneurs and businesses to grow. And they also want us to focus on technology and innovation. And almost all that kept coming back to, of those, when we looked at advanced industries, that was a place where all those came to right to the forefront, and especially aerospace. And we are so grateful, not just to Brookings, but for McKinsey, to come and give us the horsepower. It's one thing to have an idea and demonstrate. It's another thing to have internationally respected organizations come out and validate what you're really trying to put your effort behind. And we are sincerely grateful for all of your efforts on that. And we saw that notion of going out and taking what you've already got existing of, and we have a very strong, if you look at it on a per capita basis, we're either first or second in the country in aerospace. But it has all the accessory benefits, right? So the people, the engineers and the scientists that are involved in aerospace and GPS and all the support, these long tails that your good industries have, they're also involved in our schools, they're involved in our nonprofits. You know, we have in Denver, there's our Museum of Nature and Science has 65,000 paid family memberships, right? That's more than any other museum on Earth. And if you go back and look at it, a lot of that is connected to people and industries that come out of aerospace. So there's just a tremendous benefit from that. Major General Jay Lindell is here from down in Colorado Springs, but represents a connection between this industry and our military presence. We have a strong Air Force presence, a strong Army presence in Colorado. And that nexus, you know, in terms of everything from cybersecurity, a lot of that of emphasis on that in the U.S. is based down in Southern Colorado, to, you know, the notion of actually how do we make this stuff. So a lot of the GPS, space imaging, it's not just manufacturing and launching satellites and various spacecraft, although I should make sure that I point out that Mark Sarangelo is here, who's the president of Sierra Nevada Space Systems. Just if I'm plugging Colorado companies, I got to make sure. Mark is not only the president of Sierra Nevada Space Systems, but in his spare time, which I'm telling you, I get at least 10 or 15 hours a week out of him, he is our director of innovation, and has really been a great, great benefit to us. But anyway, you put all that together, and you see when you put in the same amount of effort in a bunch of different places, you're not going to get the same results. And we feel that by really emphasizing and focusing on our aerospace industry, that the accessory benefits are far, far, you know, orders of magnitude greater than if we focused somewhere else.
Mm-hmm. Now, the task of growing these industries has many challenges also. The economy posed a big one for the auto industry, and federal spending cuts poses one for defense and aerospace businesses. And there are other more perennial issues of science and technology training and education. So the next section, I wanted to talk a little bit about money and challenges, attracting investments, workforce development, and how you stay competitive. And Governor Haslam, perhaps you could talk a little bit about how your state intends to compete with Mexico and other states that are also looking to do what you're doing in your state.
Sure. There's no doubt. I think the recession of 6 years ago was a wake-up call to everybody, in terms of realizing that the game was going to look different going forward. And even though we're, you know, arguably coming out of that recession, I think most people would agree it's still a very different world than it was 5 to 10 years ago. It's a much, much more competitive world. The factors that influence things are many. In the slideshow you had, you talked about some of those in terms of labor rates, energy costs. I would argue currency fluctuations play a role in that as well. And so what we've found out in the old days, when you're competing to grow industries, it was about who was going to put together the biggest incentive package, or if you happen to have the right physical piece of property for someone. Those haven't gone away. The companies still want incentive packages. But they're adding to that the impact on their total logistics cost, which is a big issue. So the ability to attract suppliers close to the plants is, I think, more important than ever. I think, but then bottom line, it's having the trained workforce that really matters. So we've tried to really go back and say that's not something that starts when somebody's 19 or 25. It needs to start back at K. We don't talk about K-12 anymore. We talk about K-J, to having a job, and trying to realign education to recognize the realities of how competitive the world is today. One of the initiatives that we just announced, or I've announced, we hadn't passed in the legislature yet, is to what we call the Tennessee Promise, to have a promise to every Tennessean who graduates from high school that will provide 2 years of either community college or technology college absolutely free. And we say that because we have a challenge that of the jobs that are going to exist in Tennessee 10, 11 years from now, over 55% of them will require a degree or certificate. And we're in the 30s now when it comes to the number of people who have a degree or certificate. So we felt like we had to do something to shock the system, if you will, to have people say, hey, I never thought I could go to school beyond high school, but I can. And I thought your slides were great. It said of the people in advanced industries that, you know, about 50% don't require a four-year degree. Well, that means that about 50% do require at least a four-year degree. So if you're talking about those that would add a two-year degree commitment to it, the number goes way up. And the STEM disciplines are a piece of it, but I think a lot of that, and we can talk about later, is important, is where we as government, where we decide to focus our assets to make certain that we're recognizing what industry is asking of us.
Right, right. And Governor Hickenlooper, with the fiscal challenges in Washington and, of course, a general commercialization, movement toward commercialization of space, I wonder how you think about where and what kinds of investments of state dollars makes the most sense. And perhaps you could talk a little bit about your long-term outlook for federal money and for attracting private investment.
Well, I think the federal government rightfully should be just as rigorous in how they invest their dollars as any private sector business. And, you know, we compete. We all compete, right? And that's a good thing, right? The states are the laboratories of democracy. And within that context, we argue strenuously with the federal government that when we think that we've got a research chain or a direction we're taking that has real potential. So, and we try to integrate our efforts. We've worked real hard to make sure our congressional representatives, our two state senators, all of our state legislators are all on the same page and recognize that an industry like aerospace has potentially great benefits. And certain times, like a couple years ago when ITAR, you know, there were limitations on how you exported some of the new technologies coming out that were ridiculous in terms of the practical application, right? That we were allowing our international competitors to take away jobs and manufacturing from this country. So, again, we use that organized approach and really focus on, and again, not just for Colorado, but for the whole country, how can we be more pragmatic about exports and push the kinds of research dollars that come out of Washington into those places that are going to more rapidly generate real products and real services. Again, we do a lot of remote sensing, a lot of GPS. Right now, there's some issues about the resolution of some of that GPS that we have laws against or regulations against how clearly our companies in the United States are allowed to resolve images from space. Well, our competitors in Europe don't. And so suddenly they're getting an advance on us because we're worried that people see too much on the ground or, you know, well, someone else is already seeing that, right? And that's part of progress, right? Science is moving forward. Technology is moving forward. We can either stand on the side or we can be part of it. And I think that's a big part of when we think about federal investments. We should look at what the outcomes are. And that, again, sometimes you're doing pure science. You don't clearly see what the accessory benefits are. But oftentimes you've got at least an idea of what the potential is.
Let me jump. I'll give you a concrete example. Tom Mason, who's the director of the Oak Ridge National Lab in Tennessee, arguably the best national lab in the country.
One of the best. Certainly one of the best.
I have the microphone right now. They're working on carbon fiber technology there, the ability to make products lighter. And as we look at increasing fuel mileage in this country, that's one of it's obviously a huge interest to the automotive industry. I think the folks in the automotive industry would say, we know how to use carbon fiber and how to make the numbers work in a $100,000 car. We hadn't figured out how to make it work in a $20,000 car. Tom and the folks at Oak Ridge National Lab are a piece of that to say, how do we use that? So that's a place where you have a federally funded laboratory that is having direct application to what we think can really accelerate a needed advancement in the industry. We're trying to learn how to take advantage of that more, and we're using their partnership on a frequent basis as we recruit people.
Right. Governor, would you like to hit back?
Well, we have 24 federal laboratories in Colorado, so if I hit back, it really wouldn't be fair.
Obviously a quantity versus quality argument.
You know, one of the things that we've focused on, we have a kind of advanced industry accelerator program. We passed legislation last year that's going to allow us to, over the next 10 years, put $150 million into, moving companies more rapidly into embracing these innovations and patents that come out of our laboratories, whether they're federal or state or, you know, University of Colorado or University of Tennessee. We're agnostic. But part of that is getting matching grants. So we want them to go out there and try and bring money from Washington, try and find independent foundation money, and then we want to be part of that so that they can move faster. And I think to a certain extent, that kind of public-private partnership, I mean, we talk about it more frequently in terms of building roads or, you know, other types of infrastructure, but it's also going to be a bigger part of research, right? And I think that's something we both agree on, that we want to just make sure that research goes as rapidly as we can, whether it's, you know, a big company like Lockheed Martin or a smaller company like Sierra Nevada Space Systems, Ball Aerospace. We want, again, they're all going to compete with each other, but we want them to be kind of working together to bring as much monetary resource to research as possible, obviously in a competitive environment, as much to Colorado, despite our limited quality.
So that's a kind of a good segue, actually. Research and development is of course, very critical.
Would somebody please tweet that he just said there was limited quality?
R&D is, of course, very important to advanced industry, and it's also very, very expensive. But both of you mentioned your intellectual capital in your respective states, Oak Ridge National Laboratories, 24 quantity laboratories. And I think maybe could you talk a little bit more about, like, concretely, specifically, what you are doing to attract more private monies, how you're approaching that, and...
Yeah, we're trying to do several things. We started something this year called the Insight Fund, which took some of the federal grants that we got and did that to incentivize more innovation from our local and state-based companies. We're trying to, like I said, the example I used with Oak Ridge National Lab, I'll come back to that. We're trying to say, how do we take people that have a lot of horsepower, both mental fiscal horsepower, and how do we partner with them on things that we're doing? We're trying to do a better job of working with our universities. There's an incredible amount of research capacity, learning how to introduce that to the private sector hasn't ever been really easy. And I think the final thing is a lot of our large manufacturers are beginning to work with each other on some things, and there's some places where we can build a bridge to make that happen. As we're out and our economic development folks are out there, we can say, well, we're talking to, you know, X company about this, and Y company's already ahead. They're not head-to-head competitors. I wonder if there's a way we can work together.
Can you give an example in the auto industry?
Well, I'll give you an example. Since I already talked about Nissan, they actually have allowed us to put a community or a technology college on campus at their plant. They're using it to train their workers, but they're also using it to train outside workers who are coming in to take classes, you know, with a world-class manufacturer. We have some other manufacturers who are looking, saying, we wouldn't mind getting in on that for some specific skill training that we need and the exposure to another large manufacturer.
What is the challenge to commercialize the intellectual capital that you have in the state? And how are you tackling that challenge differently than you've tackled it before, Governor?
So, and then you get back down to the value of the entrepreneur to a certain extent at the small scale. We put on something every year. We created what we call the Colorado Innovation Network, COIN. We use the CO from Colorado and then the Innovation Network. And we do a summit every 2 years. And we try to take all that research that's coming out of our incredibly high-quality research laboratories, such as the National Renewable Energy Laboratory, NOAA, you know, Oceanic Atmospheric Research, not to mention CU and CSU and the Colorado School of Mines and University of Denver, all those places, and put them into a two-day summit with some large companies and small companies. The idea, how do we get capital and mentoring to those small companies, those small entrepreneurs. We attracted a couple years ago the global headquarters of Arrow Electronics, so a $20 billion a year company that loves to acquire other businesses, is not above investing in those companies when they're very small. I mean, the Coin Summit is a perfect place where that happens. This summer in August, so we'll have the third Coin Summit. Jeff Immelt, who's the chairman and CEO of General Electric, is going to come, and we've kind of are in the process of putting together an investment fund, that would be a lot of large companies involved in it, but, you know, raise $15 million that would specifically try to give investment to these very small companies that are providing specific solutions to issues. This year we're going to pick a different industry each year, but this one will be the oil and gas industry. So cleaner air, how do we recycle the water, how do we make a $250 gauge that can measure methane if it's escaping from an oil well. All those kinds of things, we want to have those possible solutions funded, and hopefully we'll have enough large companies, you know, that would be able to, you know, if the solution works, they'll be able to take it to scale very rapidly. So trying to, again, convene, bring people together. I mean, government, we're never going to create the jobs, right? Our job is to bring together the different industries and the research, and then really the entrepreneurs, right? I mean, I think that's one of the big things we lack in the country. We know when a kid's 17 whether they're going to play in the NBA or the NFL, whether they can go to Stanford or Harvard, but we're pretty clueless in terms of who are going to be the great entrepreneurs. And part of this Coin Summit, these kinds of activities are really focused on, you know, supporting them, those young entrepreneurs.
I think the other thing, when Charlie Brock is here, who runs an initiative of ours called Launch Tennessee. And one of the things they did, they had a competition this year to award some entrepreneurs. But the catch was there was a slight financial prize to it. But the real catch to it was that if you won that, you were going to get to go spend time with Fred Smith at FedEx, who started FedEx, and the folks who run Hospital Corporation of America, and the folks who run Eastman Chemical. A lot of entrepreneurs, like I said, finding the capital is one thing, but having the ability to have somebody else come in and say, hey, will this scale? What would that idea look like at the scale that we're talking about here, which is a lot of what John was talking about as well? That kind of access to folks is something that we can do because, like I said, they have great corporate citizens. We do as well, and we've always called on them to give your dollars to this community event, et cetera. Now we're asking them to come share your view of reality. Because that's what a lot of young entrepreneurs don't have is accurate view of the real world that they're going to move into.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. On the workforce question, Governor Haslam, you know, because the auto industry is becoming more highly technical, I mean, cars are more like computers.
Right.
I imagine it creates more demand for high-skilled technology workers, and this is, of course, there's a shortage of technology workers around the country, but. Can you talk a little bit about how your state is investing in that? You talked a little bit about it earlier, but how you intend to attract those workers, and feel free to mention the recent failed vote to unionize the UVW plan, if you want to or not.
I figure that might
And
come
Governor
up at
Hickenlooper,
some point.
Perhaps you could follow up after.
Yeah, I think a couple of things. Most of you have probably been, I bet everybody in this room has spent some time in an advanced manufacturing facility of one type or another. But if you did, your first impression would be that this isn't what I thought it was going to be. It's much more highly automated. And then you'd go talk about what the job requirements are, and you'd hear, you know, we need these kind of workers. So I think one of the things that we started doing is this. When John was starting his chain of brew pubs, one of the most important things you did was decide how are you going to allocate capital. And you had some stores that were growing well, so you figured out how I'm going to add on to that, and others that you didn't. But you made critical decisions about allocating capital based on what the market was telling you. In government, we haven't done that very well. When we looked at allocating capital to higher ed, it was just kind of whatever was next in line. And one of the things we're having to do is to say, what's the market telling us? And the market's being really clear. It's telling us we need more engineers and we need more welders. And I can go on down the line of doing that. We're working really hard to make sure the alignment happens. One of our state senators, Mark Norris, is here, and he's worked real hard with us on a program called LEAP, which is basically making certain we're aligning the workforce needs with the employees that we're producing. And we historically haven't done a good job of that. I'll go ahead and jump in. You mentioned the Volkswagen situation. We had a highly watched situation in Tennessee that was last week of the of the what are called the foreign transplants that operate in the U.S., none of them had been organized by the United Auto Workers. And UAW had come in working with Volkswagen to have a vote to unionize the plant. Unique situation because Volkswagen's a German company where half of the members of the management board are come from works what's their works council in Germany. And that, actually then some of the other ownership is the other half is ownership, but some of that ownership is actually state-owned. And so it was a fairly unique position that came into it. The vote was close. There were 1,600 workers who were eligible to vote. 90% of them voted, and the vote lost by 85 or 90 votes. Caught some criticism for weighing in on that. People say, well, you're an outside interest. Why are you weighing in? And I would argue, actually, the state of Tennessee has a huge investment in that plant, both fiscal, but we also in long term. Volkswagen's been real clear to us saying if they're getting ready to add another SUV line somewhere, either Chattanooga or Mexico, and they've been really clear and direct about that. And they've said, we're going to decide that, but if we decide on Tennessee, you have to do two things for us. You have to show us, you have to shrink, we got a cost gap in the car between that we can produce in Chattanooga and Mexico. You got to shrink that cost gap. And then number two, you need to bring more suppliers around us. And I was really honest with them. I said, doing either of those, I think will make it, if the plant does unionize, I think doing either one of those will make it more difficult. And it was just, for us, it's a practical decision about wanting to be able to attract industry and thinking if that vote happened, it would be more difficult.
You had mentioned earlier, working with industry to try to figure out what their
right.
workforce training needs are. Can you be more specific about certain programs or things that have come out of that partnership?
It really started, I guess about a year and a half ago, I spent time going around to every part of the state and bringing together kind of a representative group of employers, large, small, all different industries, to just listen and say, what are we not giving you that you need? If our job in our, K through higher education network is to provide the work. It's one of the. It's not the only purpose of K through higher ed education, but one of those is to provide the workforce. Where are we falling down on the job? And we had some very specific feedback about what we're doing. It was all around the STEM disciplines, and it was the message was clear. That's not something that we're talking about. You need to just start in post-secondary education. So we've ratcheted up the requirements in Tennessee to graduate from high school. You need more math and science than you used to. We're changing again how we allocate capital dollars to school. And then we're also trying to take away financial barriers for students because we have a whole lot of families in Tennessee that have just said, I never thought I could afford post-secondary education, and we want to take that barrier away.
And you know, it comes at a time, obviously, when you're budgets are hard, and I wonder. So, what are some of the priorities that you've changed, and where are some what have you taken the money away from, and what are you putting it specifically into?
I think we're moving toward a path where we're putting more money into places where job demand is higher. And so, does that mean were you saying specifically you're funding less humanities programs or something? It's really not that. We're just trying to make certain that we're going to post-secondary institutions and saying, what's your cost per degree awarded for each one of your programs? Well, every business knows, in this part of our business, it costs us X to produce a unit. We have a lot of institutions of higher education which are spending a whole lot to produce a very few degrees. Everything's not equal before everybody jumps on me. I realize that. But that's one of the factors we need to look at.
Mm-hmm. Governor Hickenlooper?
Well, I think there's a paradox in the way we do higher education, and I think it's not arguable. I mean, the United States still has the single best system of higher education in the world. But you take a state like Colorado, where we are either first or second in terms of the amount of people with either a four-year degree or even a post-high school degree or a postgraduate degree, and yet we don't do that great a job with our own kids, right? So there's a paradox. Coincidentally, of our 20 largest companies, three of the CEOs grew up in Wisconsin. They went to the University of Wisconsin. They, graduated from there. Two of my cabinet, two of the most talented people we have, came out of Wisconsin. So there's five people that the citizens of Wisconsin's probably invested $150,000 worth of subsidies in their education. There's $750,000 that's come and now is helping create jobs in Colorado and make Colorado a better place.
Scott Walker will have an invoice on your desk in the morning.
I talked to him about it. He was thinking. But I think that there is a, at the same time, if you're really trying to attract entrepreneurs, you better invest in your K-12 system and your K to J system so that your kids have a place to go. Because no young entrepreneur is going to want to raise their family in a place that doesn't have that kind of soup to nuts educational system. And somewhere out here, Ellen Gollenbeck is a head. She's here for a different reason, but she stopped in. She runs our Office of Labor and Employment. And one of the things we're trying to do is take our labor department and put it much more intimately connected with our community colleges and our four-year colleges and dramatically shorten the amount of time between when industries and businesses see specific jobs that they're going to need and how fast we have people trained. In other words, instead of just saying, well, in the next 5 years we think we're going to need these kinds of jobs and what this looks like, we want to have that down to a matter of months. That in 6 months, how many nurse practitioners or how many, analytical tool and die workers do you need? And where are they going to get trained? And how do we make sure that we have real jobs? Lockheed Martin's working on a great program now where we take returning vets and we set them up through a fairly rapid 3-month, 4-month program. But they are learning exactly the skills that they need to run some of this, very technical manufacturing equipment. And so far, we're hiring 90 to 95% of the individuals who finish that 4-month program and making sure that they have jobs that aren't just jobs, they're careers, right? They'll lead to more higher-paying jobs, and they'll be able to have a real career out of it.
And is that funded by the state, or is that funded by Lockheed
Martin? A combination, right? So that's again, we get back to these public-private partnerships, but it's trying to take the government arm of it and the state government arm of it and getting it a lot closer to the training. In this case, it's a training company that does the training from outside the public sector, and then tied in with what Lockheed Martin is saying, all right, here's what we need. The training organization does the training, and we pay for it in a combination of federal and state dollars.
And then presumably you nail them down to Colorado soil after that.
Well, they're not going anywhere near Tennessee, I'll tell you that. Just kidding.
Yeah. I was getting ready to say something nice about it. No, I still will. Left in the midst of all of our technical talk, there is a reality that quality of life matters. And if you look at the gains that Colorado's made, despite our teasing, he's too nice to brag about the fact that Colorado does have a high quality of life. And that's one of the things that mayors and governors have to look at is are we helping to create a place where people want to live and raise their family? That's a really big deal. And like I say, so they're a net gainer of people with degrees, which is a great thing for a state. And I think as we're out recruiting companies, I tell this story a lot. There's one company that we worked really hard to recruit to Tennessee, and they were in California. We finally got them to come, and they moved, et cetera. And we went to dinner afterwards, and I asked the CEO, I said, so tell me now it's over. How did you decide on Tennessee? Was it our incentive package? Was it the incredible winsomeness of the governor? What was it? And he said, honestly? And I said, yeah. And he said, my wife and I saw a place we wanted to live. So you could have saved us a lot of money. We'd have bought the house, But the point remains, in the midst of us talking about, STEM disciplines and everything else, one of our primary jobs is to create a place where people want to live.
Right.
Right. And more, that's where young people want to live because they are the workforce of the future and they attract those companies and entrepreneurs that we're looking for. So I talk all the time when we're out recruiting a headquarters to come to Colorado, or even an entrepreneur who's got a small business but you think it's going to really grow. I mean, they ask questions like, how many miles of bike path do you have in your metropolitan area, right? They ask questions, how's your music scene, right? And I, brag all the time. And 2009, 2010, 2011, more 25 to 34-year-olds moved to metropolitan Denver than any metropolitan area in the country, not per capita, but in raw numbers. And part of that is that we've got a vibrant music scene. We've got as great as Nashville is in terms of music. We have even more live music venues in Denver than we do in Nashville. As great as
those,
it is.
Where's that organization that does fact checker? This would be a good time to ask him about, since you asked me about VW, to ask him about legalized marijuana, I think.
With some of those young people, that's not as big a negative as you and I might think.
I won't go there.
So we have been talking about state initiatives here primarily, and these are programs sort of without federal backing for the most part. I wonder if you might talk a little bit about whether this is a sort of general strategy to go it alone, or whether you sort of are thinking about, you know, soliciting support from Washington, where you expect support from Washington, and whether you think that's even possible sort of in the political climate here.
It's more difficult. I'll give you a specific example. Two things that we think would really help us in advanced manufacturing, the Transatlantic Trade Investment Partnership, TTIP, and the Trans-Pacific Trade Agreement, we think are very important. And the reason I would give that, companies or countries that we have trade agreements with, our Tennessee exports are 16 times those that we don't have trade agreements with. Post-NAFTA, our trade with, if you combine Mexico and Canada, went up five or six times out of those same industries. You know, I can go on and on with examples like that. I think those two agreements are really important, and I think it's the right way to do business. Those are obviously caught up in some partisan battles now. Actually, some of it's partisan, some of it's interparty in that particular one. But that's a specific example where I think getting Washington off the dime would help us a lot.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think that governors have a role there. We may tease each other, but if you go through the National Governors Association, where pretty much I think almost every state's a member, we are much less partisan. And generally, we tease, we compete, but we also share every idea. I mean, every good idea Bill's had, he's given me. Every good idea I've got, both of them, or I've given to him.
He's come out ahead, I guarantee you.
But I think that is a better model in terms of resolving some of these issues, not just about export agreements, but immigration. I mean, here's a piece of legislation that's been stalled for, you know, over a decade, couple decades, if you measure back far enough, and yet has a huge impact on our workforce, on our communities, and somehow it's become this partisan football that goes back and forth. And, you know, my gut feeling is if the governors were going to fix it, we'd get it fixed, you know, what, a fortnight? Maybe 2 weeks, maybe a little longer. But I think those kinds of the difficult, intractable issues that have really gotten tied up in Washington, governors almost have an obligation to begin looking at and trying to figure out what are the compromises, right? And part of that, you know, when you come from business, right? I mean, when I was building restaurants, I never sold a hamburger once that I didn't know it was worth an extra dollar more than they paid me for it. I knew it was worth more, but no one would pay it. So you make that compromise every day, right? And every decision, every new transaction, there's always a negotiation and a compromise, and you never get quite what you want. Well, that's the way, you know, this country used to work politically. And somehow now we've gotten where we're drawing lines in the sand, and even on some of the easy issues, it becomes much more partisan than it should be.
I think John's point's a great one. It's an advantage, I think, having been a mayor and been a governor. Because you live with all the consequences, it tends to make you very practical. And it's, you know, when you're getting to vote on policy but not having to necessarily live with the consequences immediately, you can not be as solution-oriented. And like I said, John and I, we like I said, different parties, but I bet the way we run our state is about 90% plus similar.
So does that mean that you do sort of think about state-only programs or state-funded programs? Or?
Well, it sure makes life a lot easier, I mean, to be honest with you, to not have to involve Washington. Now, that being said, there's things that the power of the federal government can do to move something faster that it's really helpful. It's been controversial, but an example to be with education standards and a lot of debate about Common Core, and you guys are still I think, to me, having that started with a group of governors who came together who said, we need to figure out what should be common education standards. Federal government came in, not to take over, but to say, we agree, and here's some incentive to do that. I think that's moved us down the line further in terms of higher expectations. Again, that's more, though, something the innovation came out of the states. It was a group of governors saying, this is crazy. How come we're all defining proficiency in a different way? You know, the basketball goal is 7 feet in your state and 8 feet in this one and 6 feet in this one. Why don't we all say we're playing on 10-foot goals like real basketball? And the group of governors came together and said that. It then helps if the federal government can come behind and provide some assistance in doing that. I think that's a good model. Innovation coming out of the states, federal government saying, how can we help make it happen?
Mm-hmm. Well, and that creates, once you accept that, it creates an incentive for states to work together. So we have In the western states, we have an issue with the endangered species, a number of them, but the greater sage-grouse, big issue. You talk to any western governor, they are committed to making sure that the habitat is improved, that we make sure we protect the sage-grouse, and we think we can do, I think Republicans and Democrats think that we can do a better job of it than people in Washington coming in from far away, and I realize that can ruffle a lot of feathers. You'll excuse the inappropriate metaphor. But I think if the states can come together and find common ground, right, Republican states and Democrat states, and say, we'll make the compromise, this is what's going to do the best job for making sure that we enhance the viability of any of these threatened species. I mean, that makes sense. That should be where the laboratory begins to yield results that the entire nation can work with. And too much, I think 10 or 20 years ago, that was less the case. Now I think partly because of the conflict in Congress, the White House is looking for ways that how can they, without having to go through Congress, help states if we want to build transit or invest in infrastructure or get more research. They're trying to say, all right, how do we do that in a way that we can afford and that is fair and actually gets results? And that might ultimately be a good thing if the governors can continue working together.
I'm just curious, you guys alluded to talking to each other a lot, and how often do you talk, and do you talk about these issues about advanced industries?
Well, I'll give you an example. Sometime last year, I took five or six folks in our cabinet out to meet with peers in Governor Hickenlooper's cabinet. You know, being in states is an interesting deal. In most businesses where you do the same thing, you can't or won't talk to your competitor. Coke doesn't sit down with Pepsi and say, you know, what are you doing about sugar prices? You can't do that. But with states, you can, because like I said, his job, if we swap jobs, there'd be some differences, obviously, but it'd feel pretty similar. And he's dealing with human service issues and, you know, K-12 issues and all the, you know, mental health issues, all the same things that we have, corrections issues. The day we were there, I remember you'd had an issue at a prison the day we were out there. So all the job feels incredibly similar. So there's a huge incentive to go call somebody who's doing the same thing you are and saying, what are you doing about this problem?
Or a set of problems. And how do we, I think we both, many governors share the effort of trying to get more people from the private sector into our cabinets, into our senior positions. Ken Lund, who's back there, our head of economic development, used to run, you know, the largest, he was the managing partner of the largest law firm in town. So he knows everybody and understands really how economic growth happens. And, you know, he's not going to work forever for the state government, but for three or four years, his public service, Mark Sarangelo, who's now our chief innovation officer, even if I only get him for 10 or 15 hours a week, at least I'm not paying him anything. He's well compensated. Do not lose.
We'll double that pay in Tennessee.
But I think you know, trying to get people from the private sector in and to really try and find solutions. And then as you bring those people in, they have ideas from their peers in their industry from other states. And then we end up calling each other up. And, you know, I took a group of people out to Tennessee whenever it was a couple of years ago. It's a funny way, you know, that there are a couple of places where we're similar, a couple of ways we're different. Right? Coke and Pepsi, I talk all the time. I mean, they compete relentlessly. They would never share all kinds of information. At the same time, they'd also never do attack ads, right? In other words, the business community is much more, well, think about it. They do an attack ad against Pepsi, then then Pepsi will do an attack ad against Coke, and they go back and forth. They depress the entire, you know, product category of soft drinks, right? When we do these attack ads in politics, we depress the entire product category of democracy to a certain extent. And I think we rebuild that product category when we sit down with Republican and Democratic governors and roll up our sleeves and say, all right, here's what we're doing. This worked. This didn't work. But well, here's what we tried. And all of a sudden, you're moving the ball down the field.
When it comes to advanced industries, is there an idea that you got from each other that you're implementing?
I'm trying to think of one. Our discussion has been more about, I think, some of our agencies and education. I don't know if there's one.
Well, but this Tennessee Promise, right, of really focusing. So we've done a bunch of work on scholarships. We've got $30 million in this year's budget for scholarships. But what Bill's doing, he's really focusing on that first 2 years, right, so he can help everybody and offer to pretty much the same, that missing last dollar. We hadn't thought of that, and that has direct application to how you do aerospace, but STEM, I mean, all of our of these kind of advanced manufacturing jobs. So, I mean, I guarantee you, we'll within, you know, 24 hours, we'll have a couple people looking at it and talking to your people and saying, all right, here's what we've been doing. Maybe we can adapt if we don't do exactly what he's done, we're going to adapt it and use some of those ideas.
Great. All right. Well, let's. We're going to open up to audience Q&A. There's going to be some roaming mics. Yes, just raise your hand, and please be sure to identify yourself and your affiliation. And I've been asked to also make sure that it's germane to this discussion. yes.
I think I forgot the question. I'm Garrett Mitchell, and I write the Mitchell Report, and I want to ask the governors to do a little thinking out loud for us on a subject that seems to come right out of this conversation, and it also happens to be something I know that our host, Bruce Katz, has been doing a lot of thinking and writing about, and that is often called the new federalism. And what I'm struck by in listening to both governors is the extent to which they are able to get things done at the state level because they're in touch with reality and they have to live with their results. We know what the story is here. It seems that one of the possible solutions, if not in whole, is how do we begin to think about shifting certain responsibilities, for example, that are currently at the federal level that the states could take over or do a more effective job with? And I'm just curious to hear some of that thinking from them.
So I think that's what the National Governors Association is talking about. You know, now Brookings has been involved in that conversation intimately and looking at where, I mean, every state has a serious problem with transportation infrastructure. And we all are talking about public-private partnerships, but especially as this next generation of fuel-efficient vehicles comes on board, the amount of revenue for just maintaining roads, let alone expanding and trying to mitigate some of the congestion we all experience, that resource is going to go down. So one solution would be to provide more federal funding directly to states or metropolitan areas and look at, you know, what are the local incentives for them to match and take responsibility and really take more of the federal government out of the mix. And I think when you begin thinking in those terms, you begin looking at a bunch of different issues where that makes a certain amount of sense.
I'll wander into dangerous territory again. you can make an argument that just the size of the task that what we're trying to do on the national level is just too big. And the dangerous territory I was going to walk into was going to be the rollout of the Affordable Care Act. Forget what you think about the act, whether it was good or bad. But the difficulty and complexity of of the task, I think in foresight and in hindsight, you could say, you're restructuring that large percentage of the U.S. economy. I would argue that there would have been more effective ways to do that involving the states. And again, forget the politics of it. I'm not talking about that. I'm talking about just the implementation of it. I just think it's gotten so, the country's so big, so diverse, and so difficult that the problems are huge. And so in some ways, it's not real surprising all the argument that's happening up the hill here.
Next question, back there? Or?
Did you pass this down?
Oh, okay.
The mic's coming.
thank you. I'm Paul Barton with the Tennessean newspaper. Governor Haslam, in particular, do you see stopping unionization as essential to advancing or growing these advanced industries?
No, I don't. And I've been real clear about that. In that case with Volkswagen, it was a situation, like I said, where we're doing this kind of twofold dance with Volkswagen at this point. Number one, they're looking at the possibility of unionization. Second, they're coming to us talking about building another vehicle there. And I said, listen, you know, if you're beating us up on one side saying you got to get the cost of the vehicle down and you got to bring more suppliers around, you just need to know that task is going to get a lot harder if UAW comes in, because that's not just my opinion. I had suppliers telling us that if they come, we won't come. And so there was a direct link in this case. We obviously have worked with General Motors, which has a unionized workforce in Spring Hill, Tennessee. and a lot of other companies. In this particular case, because I was hearing from so many of the potential suppliers, I thought it was important to let them know the connection.
Gentleman here.
Hi, I'm Fred Altman, and I'm wondering, you know, it seems there's a lot of cooperation between parties at the governor's level. How come the governors don't have a larger influence on their congressional delegations to so it can be more effective?
No, I'll let you answer this.
You know, I would answer this way. I mean, I hate to say it, that's how democracy works. I mean, our congressional folks, I have a great relationship. We have nine members in the House and obviously two senators. I have a great relationship with almost all of them. But they would also make it clear they were elected for their own reasons, and they also would make it real clear because actually several members of our House delegation are former members of our state legislature, and they would tell you the culture doesn't transplant, if you will, that it is a move that the issues and the positioning and the partisanship is so much stronger. I would love to tell you we can influence more than we do or can. I don't know if you have them.
No, I think it's the system is structured now, especially in Congress, where it's just very difficult. You know, I don't envy any congressional representative right now. They go in, the power of lobbyists has never been higher, probably going back all the way to the beginning of the country. The transparency, all the sunshine laws, which I'm defending, just in case the journalists out there are getting ready to tweet something. Love transparency, but when every single vote you make that decides who gets who's a winner and who's a loser, when the world knows exactly how you voted, generally there's going to be a lot of pressure on you to say yes to everything, right? Because you can't come out of the meeting and say, God, I fought for you the best I could, but we just couldn't get you that funding. It's all transparent. And I think that makes... It forces our congressional representatives into a more parochial situation where they are, you know, making these decisions strictly based on survival to a certain extent.
In some ways, our task, I mean, it's those of us in state government love to say, Washington, get your act together. But our task is easier than theirs, to be honest with you. I mean, it's a different environment. When John gave his example about his, you know, when he had his restaurants, that he always thought that hamburger was worth a dollar more than he could get paid for it. But ultimately, the market said, well, here are the consequences. We think your hamburger's worth this. Because we have to deal with immediate consequences, we're forced to make those decisions now. And that's not necessarily true at the federal level. So I think that the reality, I mean, I presented a budget 2 weeks ago, and since that once you present the budget, then everybody comes and tells you what you left out of there. And I'll be honest with you, the things they come to me aren't bad ideas. 95% of the people, stuff that people come and say, you need to put more dollars here, I actually agree with them. I just don't have the dollars to put there. And so there's a fundamental dose of reality in our budgets that Washington doesn't have the situation to deal with.
I'm Sandy Apgar. One of the core industries that's missing from the Brookings McKinsey list is construction. And although it's primitive in an industrial sense, it's very advanced in fields like energy utilization, materials science, mega project management, and so on. Have either of you or both of you investigated or supported innovations in the way this country is built, the way your states are built, not just in infrastructure, the horizontal part, but even the verticals?
We have, and again, I'll refer back to Oak Ridge National Lab in terms of some of the material science and things. They're helping us with that and attract it. I guess it's almost a question I'd love to ask you back as governors. I guess we look at the construction industry as being a, the result of the demand in other industries. Help us understand how we should look at it as an industry in its own right. That's a question, if you don't mind answering.
On the demand side, the policies you pursue to create jobs creates the demand right. for space.
Right.
The policies that you may or may not pursue, but that often result on how that infrastructure, both horizontal and vertical, is used and ultimately recycled,
right.
rebuilt for a different quality of life, a different environment. That's the broader picture.
Okay.
And I would suggest at least that states, as Bruce and others have argued, have a central role, along with cities too, of course, but states have a central role in how that happens, because business, the job creators, respond directly to both the incentives you've described,
yeah.
but also the kinds of policies that you adopt.
Well, certainly the level of innovation that we see, and again, I think we compete on these innovations as well, the transitions between what architects do now, and architects now, if you look at the Olympics, great example, Populous, which is one of the major subcontractors and architecture firm that worked to create the Olympics based in Colorado, but they are looking more than just how you build a building. But after the Olympics is over, how this gets broken apart, how can there be other uses? How do the people, how do the people flow? What's the overall image and brand of those, that assemblage of buildings? I mean, it becomes much more of a sociology and not just bricks and mortar. We've got another company in North Denver that is now taking GPS technology to the point where you hold a rod, and that rod, it tells you exactly that's where you put the corner of your foundation, right? So you don't have to get out there with the tape measure and put a little rod and do all that stuff anymore. You're building stuff now without having to do that. Again, people aren't using paper anymore. I mean, that is all happening dramatically and rapidly. And the companies that are more rapid in adopting those innovations are going to get more of the contracts and bring more of that work back to our states. And our competition there is just as fierce, I'm sure.
Back there.
Hi, I'm Julia Edwards with Reuters. Governor Haslam, I heard you talk about how bringing federal funding into something can sometimes just make the task too arduous, especially in spurring additive or advanced manufacturing. President Obama has been touting in the State of the Union these innovation centers where private and public partnerships come together in various states and compete for federal dollars for these exact kind of technologies. I wondered if that's something you would encourage your states to look into, or if that in any way would influence picking a winner or maybe taking away some IP rights by bringing together different companies.
The second two issues you brought up are real in terms of government picking a winner or IP rights. But we have either eight or nine, I can't remember somebody in here, probably either eight or nine business accelerators around the state who are doing something similar, focusing on certain industries. We have one called Auto Accelerate, based again on our auto strength, using either grants that we have available or expertise that we have available to provide more opportunity and to kind of spur growth along. So I don't actually know enough about the president's proposal to have an opinion on that. I know what that works like, what that looks like. I said we're using that to be a lot more targeted rather than just say we're going to take whoever comes next with a good idea.
But part of that can also be done in terms of the ecosystem you're creating, and we've looked at how do you take a few square miles and make sure that you have the fiber, like what Google's doing, so that you have 100 times the speed of downloading, so you can download a movie literally in a minute or a matter of seconds, and putting that in certain areas where you want to see economic development, where you have an underserved neighborhood or community. And that, then the government doesn't really have to pick winners. Geographically, we're picking winners, I guess, but you're encouraging all the entrepreneurs and all the businesses that need that kind of speed to come set up shop there.
Right, but I would comment, that's a good example, though. We've talked before that because Denver's such a great job and economic hub that some of the other parts of the state, it's harder to encourage growth. So if Denver becomes one of Google's cities and they're looking, I think Nashville's one of the ones being considered as well, that'll make it even harder to encourage the growth to happen somewhere else. So there are ramifications when all that happens.
And I think that's each state. I'm sure you're doing the same things we are. I mean, we have the old high-cost fund. We're kind of deregulating telecom. But as we do that, the High Cost Fund, which was originally created to make sure that every rural community got telephone service, if they'd had the word broadband back then, they would have used it, right? And we all share that same responsibility that we want to have, you know, redundant high-speed broadband in every corner of the state. And it's going to take a while, probably the better part of a decade, to really get everywhere. But that's the basic building block that everyone should have equally.
I think we have time for one brief question. back there, maybe?
Pete Carlson. I'm just curious. Given your previous experience at the local level, how do you now think about the role of mayors and others at the local level in doing the kind of work that we've been talking about here today?
Boy, I miss being a mayor. No, I'm just kidding. You know, that done properly, and I think it's very analogous, and we spend a lot of time. On my day of inauguration, right? So I stayed being mayor right up until the day I became. Day I became governor. So I resigned in the morning. I walked across. We have it between the city hall and state capitol.
You didn't get two paychecks that day, did you?
No. No, I decided that one day I'd go unpaid. But we walked across what we call Civic Center Park, and then did the inaugural address. And my executive order was to make sure that the state would do nothing to put an unsupported mandate on our local governments, our municipalities and our counties, that we would not burden them with something and expect them to come up and pay for what we decided was best for them. It is very analogous to how we feel about the federal government, right? That there's got done properly, the local communities, whether you're talking about job creation or education or healthcare, somehow there's got to be a seamless, as close as you can get, a relationship between your local community and your state, and that together then you are navigating this with the federal government. And we saw this, you know, when we had the drought and then the fires, and then we had these floods last September, and we realized we had to get people back connected to their homes and their jobs and their community before the snow came. And there's just no way the federal government's going to do that, no way the state's going to do that. Right? But we had to be part of it. And so our fire drill there was to get out there and say, all right, how do we get the decision process from bottom to top as fast as possible, right? And we whatever waivers we need, whatever we need to change, we just don't have time to luxuriate and, you know, kind of worrying about this and it or that and that. And it can be done. That's the magic of a real life issue where time and urgency is paramount. You see really what you can do. And I think that, you know, I think Tennessee does a good job of this as well. I'll let Bill speak, but that segregation of federal government and then state government and then local and municipal government, somehow we've got to blur those lines and make their interrelationship much more collaborative.
My answer would be this. I believe more than ever that the closer to home government is, the better it is. I mean, when people can grab you at the supermarket or church or Little League baseball game, whatever, it's just going to be better. And I think the other thing you see is this. You see it played out in so many ways. I called or emailed John not long ago. He's gone through a remarkable string of stressful situations, from floods to fires to shootings to a lot of things that are high stress and high demand. In all those, it wasn't just the state. You had a local government that was involved as well. So whether we're talking about that or recruiting advanced industry, I see it all the time. I work with local governments, and I see the ones that are prepared and have their house in order and have done the homework so that when the opportunity comes, they're ready. And the leadership matters. I don't know a better way to say this. And you see the difference when you're in our office and you deal with local leadership of all type. Local leadership is the best. And who you elect matters. And I don't say that in a political sense. I just say it does matter who governs and who leads. And the opportunities and stresses are across the board, federal, state, and local. The local folks might make the most difference of all.
Fair enough. And let me just add into that last thing. Sometimes we look at the federal partners and we don't think of like our military assets, especially in things like disasters like that. But our National Guard, every single state is closely and deeply dependent on our National Guard. And the more bridges, that's why having Major General Lindell kind of as our champion for aerospace, but he comes directly out of the military and, again, helps build those bridges and add real muscle to that relationship.
Thank you so much.
So I just want to thank both of you and Yuki for an informed conversation, but also a civil conversation because
he still didn't give us the Broncos.
It's a good thing your states are not next to each other, or this would have disintegrated rapidly. Everyone, let's thank the governors. Let's thank Yuki. And watch this space. There will be more on advanced industry from McKinsey and Brookings. We really appreciate your coming today. Thank you.